This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. On today's episode, we are joined by Dan Keeling, one half of Noble Rot, to talk about their new book, Wine from Another Galaxy. We talk about the comparisons of wine and the music industry, the Noble Rotters road trip, and how their first wine list was like putting out their first record. Later in the show, we're joined by Adam Schatz of Landlady to discuss his new record that's coming out later this month. We discuss the creative output during the pandemic, his early adoption of the sourdough craze, his tour food blog that takes you from point A to point B while on the road with your band, stopping at all the delicious spots along the way, and his relentless year of learning using a Randy Newman song as a backdrop. So sit back, relax, and here's another episode of Snacky Tunes on HRN.
We talk about food. About music with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Took an hour off my day at the top, holding breath cannot prevent the stomach drop, fall below. To die, why do we fix our focus on the lies that we can't see, we can't know.
I know.
welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. We are joined today by Dan Keeling of Noble Rot. Dan, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on the book. But before we get to that, I want to lay a little bit of groundwork. A lot has been said about your previous music career that we don't need to cover today. But I'm curious to ask you of why you think so many people from the music industry, either from labels or from bands, end up in the world of natural wine.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it comes down to food and wine being, you know, sense related, music, obviously sense related, art, you know, film. If you're that way inclined, you're probably going to be into all of these things. And I think maybe people of Generation X probably made a few quid in the music industry and then they could afford to go to restaurants and then they got obsessed by something else. Because the best people that I've met in the music industry have all been obsessives, the people running great labels and doing good things, bands, you know, they're obsessed about, you know, playing the guitar or whatever. So that's probably why.
One of the things that's covered in your books is a really strong comparison between record album covers and wine labels. What have you found that's analogous between the two of them, both in the approach and the aesthetic?
Oh, God, you know, natural wine, for want of a better term, kind of busted the whole thing wide open with the label design. So, you know, it's such a broad subject, but it's so funny. Natural wine, a lot of natural wine producers or some natural wine producers will really try and interpret their ethos for life through the colorfulness or the kind of the anarchy maybe of their labels as well. And that's kind of similar in music. I think it's a bit like nailing your colors to the mast. You know, so many people nowadays, they probably get into a bottle of natural wine because of what it looks like and they can go home and show their friends, which in some ways, that's as good a reason as any to do it, you know. And then you look at kind of old labels and people like Mouton Rothschild, who did a different label every year and have used some fantastic artists. So again, it depends who the person is making the wine, if they're artistic minded or if they're not. But like music, it's funny that a lot of the wines I really love probably don't have much of a label. They've probably got the most boring label. And that was always the same at the label that I worked at, the record label. Because when you got a demo that had been sent in and it had fancy packaging, the music was probably poor. And the ones that were just someone scrawled on it like a two-year-old, then it was always the best one. You wanted to sign it. So, yeah, it's interesting. It's definitely a part of your experience is what the bottle looks like, you know.
Going back to the inception of the magazine, 2013, what was the current landscape of wine writing? And what gap did you see in it that you felt that you and your partner, Mark Andrew, could fill?
Yeah, around that time, there was a magazine called Fire and Knives, run by a guy called Tim Hayward, who is now the Financial Times restaurant critic. And that wasn't necessarily a wine magazine, it was a food magazine, but it was that DIY kind of fanzine-y type thing that I'd seen before in music with like magazines like Jockey Slut magazine, which was in Manchester, which was a dance music magazine, which I used to write for when I was at college. And, you know, Junior Boys Own that Andy Weatherall and all that crew used to do. So I saw Fire and Knives and my partner Mark saw it as well. And we were like, this is really interesting. It was beautifully made. It was obviously home produced and it was a thing. It was from a place of passion rather than commercialism. It didn't have any adverts. So that kind of got us thinking, well, you know, if they can do it, then so can we. And no one's really doing that in wine. So at the time you'd have Decanter magazine in the UK. There's a guy, Stephen Spurrier, who was the guy who set it up and he died 3 days ago, which is like a massive loss to the wine community because he was just such a brilliant communicator about wine. And around that time, Decanter was probably still quite a good magazine and had lots of different writers that were the good and established and very knowledgeable, but they didn't talk about it necessarily in the way that we would talk about it. We wanted to try and talk about it in the way we talked about music and art and films, and they would maybe talk about it a little bit more like it was in isolation. You know, what are you going to give this wine out of 100 points to park away? You know, list a few, you know, what does it smell of? And that to us just kind of went against what we loved about wine, the escapism of wine. It was kind of, it was a bit like listening to a record and trying to identify all the different synths on it, you know, or what's that guitar? And that's just nerdy. It's just, it's not why we want to do it. We want to listen to an amazing piece of music because it takes you somewhere else. So that's kind of what we thought we could do. And the other thing was when we got together, Mark and I, and started thinking about a magazine, we had both been reading Adventures on the Wine Route by Kermit Lynch from California. And Kermit, you know, he's a brilliant writer, and he also writes with a sense of humor as well as an opinion. And it wasn't all about reductive kind of reducing wine down to components. It was about culture. It was about people. It was about places. And that's what we wanted to do. And that's, I think, what part of the aim for the book is the people and the places and communicating about them to other people and being hopefully inspiring them to go and drink those wines as much as we want to go and drink those wines.
Starting a magazine would be enough. I mean, it was, I don't want to say overnight success, but it was so incredibly well received. Would have been fine, but you're like, let's keep going. How about we open up our own restaurant and wine bar? When you were putting together your first wine list, what were some of the considerations that you had? Were you comparing it against anyone? Was it your own personal high standard? What, you know, consider it like a first record almost, because no one was asking for it. You had all the time in the world to do it. What thoughts went into it before you put it out into the world?
Yeah, the number one thought, which still is the number one thought now, is do we want to drink these wines? You know, we want to be able to sit and stand by every single wine on the wine list and drink it and drink the one next to it and love it. So that's the first thing. You know, we went to Paris just before we opened the first Noble Rot, and we did a bit of a scouting trip going around all the wine bars and restaurants. Places like Vivant was a big inspiration for us, and Clown Bar. This is before we'd actually got the property. And we came back, you know, very inspired, but a little bit deflated, because we thought there's no way we're going to find a period building like these places in London, because they've all been bombed by Nazis or turned into Costa Coffees. But luckily we did. We found something from 1709 and on Lambs Conduit Street, which really fitted the bill. So that was great. But going back to the wine list, you know, a lot of those places I've just mentioned, like Vivant and Clown Bar, they're natural wine bars, and that's all they would sell. We love a lot of natural wine. We don't like all natural wine, because I think it's like any kind of wine. There's a very small part of it that is really well made. And we also wanted to put like first growth claret on there, because we love that as well. So normally those two worlds are a little bit kind of, you know, they don't really mix. But to us, we just that's kind of what we wanted to do. We wanted it to be eclectic. We wanted it to be like the Balearic of the wine world. Yeah. So, and then it was always about making sure the price points are right, because you want the wines for nerds, and you want the wines, if you can afford to come in and drink Armand Rousseau Chambertin, that's great, but that's a tiny part of the population, and that's, you know, a very, very expensive wine. So you've got to be offering amazing wines for, you know, £25 and under. You've got to make sure your house wine is killer. And that is really hard. That's the kind of hardest thing to do with putting together a wine list, is your house wine. You know, when it gets down to sub £5, you're trying to find the wine. A lot of it's going on duty. A lot of it's going on the bottle, the transport. There's not much left over for the actual wine. So that's still the holy grail. And we've got a white wine for Lambs, for both of our restaurants, that we also sell to other shops, called Chin Chin, which took on a bit of a life of its own over lockdown. It's a Vina Verde. You know, we did our own label. It's really light, refreshing, a bit spritzy, and it seems to really connect it with people.
You do serve a wide range of clients, from the very high-end wine whales down to people who are maybe just getting into it. And the magazine deals with it, collecting adventures, how to, you know, we all the way up to people who are just like, I will never drink this. I will never drink this vintage. I will never go below this certain price point. One of the quotes I got from you was that you're always trying to create space for new wines. So how do you do that? Like, how do you get people to open up their palates and their minds to something, whether they're new or they're set in their ways?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I think probably one that our sommeliers would be better placed to answer, because they do that on a daily basis. You know, when you talk to somebody about Tenerife wine, I mean, we kind of got into Tenerife a few years ago. This resurgence, this renaissance of viticulture on the island. And in the UK, I don't know about the States, but Tenerife is known for package holidays and not particularly salubrious package holidays. So when you talk to someone about Tenerife wine, they're looking at you like, you know, you're trying to pull a fast one. So in the past, I think back and I remember like seeing friends and saying, you've got to try this, and them having that look on their face. So it's a slow process with some people. But then you have other friends and other people who want to try something new. So it's about the mindset of the person. There's nothing wrong with coming to a restaurant or a wine shop and you know that you just like Bordeaux and you just want Bordeaux, and that's fine. But I think people are more open than ever to try new things. That's partly to do with price as well. So many classic wine regions have escalated in price. But then also there's other classic wine regions like Muscadet, for example, that you can still get for a pittance that offer amazing value. So you've got to read your customers, I think, and you don't try pushing something to somebody who's really not interested, who just is set in their ways. But it's interesting because, as you know, there's so many different areas coming on. It almost feels like every month there's another country stroke area that's been rediscovered, and there's like some 30-year-old vigneron who's, you know, got a small loan and is up a steep mountainside making amazing wine. So it's one of the most amazing times of wine ever.
It's like his great-great-grandmother had it and it was lost, and then the deed was found, and it turns out there is like a patch of 80-year-old vines and the soil is perfect. It's just got some bad topsoil, and then you're like, wow, like this is the new – you're like, wow. And then you're on a plane. And it wasn't enough for you guys just to have a restaurant. And the second restaurant opened last year, but you also started an import company. Yeah. Why? What were you not getting from your, you know, fellow countrymen importers that you needed to start your own? And what was that process?
Well, Mark, my business partner in Noble Rot, his background is as a wine buyer. So he would be out finding producers and working with producers for a merchant. And obviously my background's in A&R, which is the same thing, but just with musicians. So I think we naturally both gravitate towards, let's get to the grassroots, because the grassroots is the really interesting place to be, you know, talking with vignerons, being in the vineyard. Once you stand there with those people in that place, you understand it a bit more. So I think that was the first thing. The second thing was, it was an opportunity. We were buying wines on the continent. We would buy cellars, we would buy at auctions, and then we would bring the wines back. And there were just opportunities came up to work with great people that, you know, we couldn't turn down. You know, one of our first clients was Jean-Marc Rouleau in Meursault, who had become a friend, and his wines are, you know, some of the best on the planet. And that, you know, we couldn't, that was like having Radiohead on your label, you know, it's like them signing to XL after EMI. And then there was people like Ulysse Collin, Olivier Collin in Champagne, same thing. And from there, you meet other people and you taste other wines. And I mean, I love the importing side of it, because you're spending time in the place where it comes from, you know, the source. So that's the really exciting part of importing. And the restaurant bit, obviously, that's a whole different discipline and has many, many, many more moving parts, and is fraught with all the things that we know about being a restaurateur. So, yeah, two different things.
We're going to take a quick break and play a song from the archives, and then we're going to be back to talk about your new book, Wine from Another Galaxy, here on Snacky Tunes.
Seems like I've been using some ties. I can't recall the love that I'm after, broken nose. Pay for all the chances you're supposed to have. If I could, then I'll try 100 times before to get through the absence. Distant shores, I wonder if I change colors throughout her. The world could be a fantasy. I live through days of hustle memory. The differences we make up between us on each toe. Ice cream melts the bottoms of your toes. Turning
As we mentioned, you have a book that just came out in the States, Noble Rot, Wine from Another Galaxy. You brought up Kermit Lynch's Adventures on the Wine Route, which is just reads like a, you just wish you could have gone with him. It's like a guy just like, you know, on the path, having the best adventures. I know that he is demure in the book about how it's work, but it sounds pretty fun. You too have a similar Rotter's Road Trip, which is the second half of the book, that has so many tabs in my browser open. It's like, I got to get this one. I got to find this one. I got to get this person. Tell me about the road trip. How was it put together? I want to believe it was one long, amazing sojourn, but I can't imagine that your livers could have held up. But how did it get put together? And what was the, what are some of the highlights and maybe a couple lowlights as well?
I mean, I would like it to be one long trip too, but I think it's a bit artistic license. You know, the road trip, in all truth, started around February 2014 when Mark and I went on our first wine visits together, and we went to the Jura. There's a festival there that they do every year called Le Percy de Vanjone, and it's held outdoors in February in the Jura, which is one of the coldest fucking places in the world. So we went there, and that was it. We started doing visits together. We went to see Pierre Uvenoir. We went to see, you know, quite a few other Jura vignerons, Stefan Tiso. And then over the course of the next 7 years, we've been going away every 2 months to different wine regions. And these are places that we're discovering for the first time because, you know, you read Rioja on a bottle, but until you go to Rioja, I have no idea what Rioja looks like, or Ribera Sacra. Or even Burgundy, you know, the first time you go to Burgundy and you stand in Givry Chambertin and you go, fuck, this is where this wine is actually from. So we've been doing that and writing a lot for the magazine, done a lot of interviews. Some of the material has been printed in the magazine and rewritten and kind of made to flow all together. But really to do it like we've done it just takes such a long time. And, you know, it's... And processing it as well, because you go there, you go to the Jura and they tell you they've got like X amount of grapes. They make all these different styles of wine. Some growers have got 50 different cuvées from like 2 hectares of land or something silly. And you just you can't hardly process this information. So, yeah, the answer is it's taken a long time to kind of put it together. But I think that's the best way for us to do it. I know other people have done similar and they've done it in much more condensed version, but like you say, I don't think your liver can take too much of that. So, and it's a continuous.
I was gonna say, it reads beautifully like one long trip.
Oh, good, good. But there's so many bits in there that we haven't, that we wish that we'd got into the book. Like in the new issue of our magazine, I've written about Chianti. And Chianti was one of those wines that, you know, I'd had a few good Chiantis, and I really liked Montevertine, that's why we went there, to go and see Montevertine. But since going there, you realize that there's all these friends of Montevertine, like Monte Raponi, like Tenuta Di Carlione, and they're all kind of similar age to us, and they're making these most amazing wines, all organic, and it's just another like little world that we knew only a little bit about. So I wish we'd been able to get that in the book. And every time we go away, it seems like there's a whole other... It's like when you go in a record shop and you look for Kraftwerk, and then you work out that Kraftwerk was mates with David Bowie, and then you go, oh, David Bowie, so he worked with Iggy Pop. So you kind of, that's how you do it with wine as well. It's just kind of related relations.
I mean, it's interesting because growing up as a, you know, my brother and I are lifelong music fans. Sometimes when you find a band, you just kind of want to hold on to it for yourself. I mean, a lot of bands, you know, you want to shout from the rooftops, you're an A&R guy. But sometimes you just want to keep it personal. How do you balance that with the wine that you find? You know, I mean, some of these people are such hidden gems. They're making a handful of bottles. You know that you could probably import them, but you want to keep it for yourself. Like, where is the line that you draw between what's shared and what's yours?
God, that's a good question. You know, sometimes in France, they've got a very different way of dealing with customers in restaurants, because they will advertise wines on their wine lists. And then when you go to want to buy them, they'll say, no, that's the owner's and he's keeping it for themselves. Because that, you know, we couldn't live with ourselves if we did that in London. And we would just get crucified if I put something on the list that was rare and they said, oh, no, I'm keeping it. But it's a good question. We don't hold back wines. We only hold with our wine lists, if stuff comes in, if we want to drink it, sure, we'll put a bottle aside and that'll be ours. But we don't hold it back in the cellar and not sell it to certain people. You know, we're not kind of snobby selective like I know that some places are a bit more so. So I think you just have to just let it go, really. You know, there's so much great wine out there. It's just if someone discovers something and the prices escalate, and it is like bands, because at school I remember buying like Nirvana Bleach or whatever, and someone saying, oh, what's that you've got in your brown paper bag from the market? And I pulled it out and they said, oh, what, Headbanger Music or whatever. And then like 2 years later, they're the ones wearing the t-shirt and like going, and it's the same with wines, isn't it? You know, you get onto that wine early, and then 2 years later, somebody around the other side of the world is paying 500 quid for it, and you bought it for £20. And that is, you just let those wines go. That's the answer. You know, there's some wines that literally I bought for 20 years ago. This sounds like such an old bloke's things to say. You're 20 years ago, I bought this for 20 quid. But it's hyperinflation in the wine world. It's just crazy. So yeah, easy come, easy go.
The first part of the book is all about tasting, ordering, collecting. For people who have made a little bit of extra money and are getting into this, it can get expensive very, very quickly. You can spend all of your money on it. What are some tips that you have for people on who want to maybe not just go to the shop and drink it? How would you recommend they start collecting bottles, and what should they be looking for?
Yeah, I mean, I would recommend starting off by buying 6 bottles of something. Rather, I mean, you can start off buying a couple here, a couple there, but it's really interesting when you actually buy 6 bottles of a wine that you really like, and you can see how the wine develops over like 2-3 years. Depends how quickly you drink it. You might drink it in a week, I don't know. But also you can see there's bottle variation, which is another very interesting thing about wine, that no wine, when you get into artisanal wine, no bottles are exactly the same as the next. But I would really just say, just start with stuff you like, because don't buy stuff because you think you should be. If you're not into natural wine, don't buy that. Buy whatever you want to buy. So, yeah, that's how I would start. But also the flip side of that is just go and taste as much as possible. Make friends with the guy in the local wine shop who's got good taste. See what they're getting in, and off you go.
You also art directed the book, which is like another hat to wear. when you were putting this together, and the photos are great, the illustrations are amazing. It's really conducting an orchestra here, because as you move through the book, you get different feelings. I've never gotten bored as I turn the pages, and it is 350 odd pages. When you were giving it an aesthetic, what went into your mind? What did you want people to feel and experience while they were reading about things that they couldn't actually drink?
Yeah, the second half of the book is much more photographic, as you've seen. So we were just very fortunate to work with such talented photographers and have them along on the trips with us. A guy called Benjamin Maman, a guy called Juan Trujillo Andrades, and another guy called Tom Cochran were the main three. And what I think is really great about their photography is it has that kind of energy to it, especially Ben McMahon's. He uses a lot of flash. There's a picture in the book of Anselm and Guillaume Solos from Champagne. And I remember when we did the setup for that, there's a Sex Pistols photograph. I think they're coming out of a phone box in London and they're pulling a can of Foster's Lager and it's just spurting everywhere. And I knew that Anselm was really into like disgorging wine. And so we purposely went for a setup like that. And that's just something that doesn't really happen in wine media or food media that much. So it was really fun taking kind of influences and stuff I'd seen in music and then trying to put them with these vignerons who a lot of the time, like Solos, he's an artistic guy. When he talks about wine, he doesn't talk about it like a scientist necessarily. He talks about it like a poet, like an artist. So they were really up for doing stuff like that. And then the illustration side of it, I guess it's kind of subconsciously we love stuff like Monty Python's Flying Circus. And, you know, we've seen enough kind of interesting graphics from album design and film. And again, take that, you know, wine should be this vibrant culture. And I think that there's so many people who it's all crossed over so much more. Like you were saying earlier, there's a lot of people who, you know, they would have been just into music and going out and nightclubbing when they're 25. And, you know, I guess we're all a little bit stereotypical, but as we get a bit older and you think, God, I can't stay up till 6 a.m. anymore. What am I going to replace it with? And, you know, you start learning about this other side of life. So it's bringing those influences into food and wine was really interesting for us.
In the book, you discuss hunting for mature wines, either going into different cellars or different art auctions. It brought to mind the scene from High Fidelity where Rob gets called and said, you know, there's this woman, husband's been cheating on her. Here's this entire cellar of record collections. You can take all the vinyl for $20. And I'm wondering if you have come across any moments, not particularly that, where you've just, someone didn't know what they were sitting on and you were able to get into a collection or someone's cellar or heard any stories in the same way where people were found old vintages, rare bottles, et cetera, that were able to just, you know, an unbelievable find.
Yeah. We've taken wines from cellars of people, friends that we know who've got unbelievable cellars and have put them together. You know, in the 90s when a lot of the wines then were just cheap as chips and now have turned into icons. So we've got access to those kind of cellars. But in terms of that poor old widow whose husband's just died and has a load of, Lafitte or whatever that she wants to sell for £5 a bottle, we haven't found that. And, you know, we're much too nice of blokes to do anything like that. But that is a nice thought that finding people's cellars, being able to have access to old wines that have been in one place and then stored with perfect provenance is the holy grail. And it's very hard to do. You know, I love going to the old cellars and seeing what's there. And buying wine on the market, old wine, is fraught with these pitfalls that you just don't know where wine has been for the last 30 years, how many times it's been traded. But if you could go to somebody's cellar and they say, oh, my husband bought it 30 years ago and it's been sitting there, that's kind of, that's the dream scenario, isn't it? That's, you know, it's like going to a record fair and finding all the records that you want for like £5 or whatever, you know, which has happened in the past as well. So a nice thought, Greg, a nice thought.
One could dream. And if it does happen, or you do hear a rumor, I guess if you're a nice person, you would just never tell. You would just quietly do it and be like, surprise, yeah. we've got some rare ones.
But we have got, buying at auction though, just to finish off. I mean, that's where you can really pick up some bargains, depending on who else is bidding. So I would say that can happen.
How does that work? I feel like there's so much knowledge out there now. When it comes to auctions, are they private? Are they public? Like, how do you get that competitive edge when everyone is looking at the same thing?
Yeah, auctions have been a bit different over the last few months because of lockdown. I think there's been a lot of people sitting in, and as lockdowns happened, a lot of the auction houses, the technology's got good enough that people can sit in their living room and bid on stuff. So we've seen over the last few months that prices have been quite high. But I think it is a bit of a time of change for auction houses because of technology. You know, you're taking a chance when you buy an auction. You could have an amazing wine, or they might have been badly stored and you're writing them off. So when we sell them in our restaurant, it's on, you know, we take the risk. And the beauty of a restaurant for the customer is the bottle's open at the table, it's off, you don't pay for it. Whereas, you know, if you buy it for yourself, you could have six bottles of something quite expensive and they're all going down the drain. So you got to know what you're looking for. You got to set, you know, your targets. And Mark, my business partner, like his you know, does so much buying at auction, traveling around. You know, we go to Europe, we look for sellers all over the country, sellers in Europe as well. So it's a constant hunt.
Before I let you go, I want to get your thought on the current state of UK wine. I've seen in some previous interviews, it's not completely there yet, but you might have some favorites. If I was coming and you wanted to share some hometown wine with me, where would you point me to that you would stand up to anywhere in the world, or almost stand up to?
Yeah. Last September, we did a competition, English sparkling wine against champagne, blind. And it was a repeat of 5 years previously. And the 5 years ago competition, an English sparkling wine won. We had half English sparkling and we had half champagne. It was a wine called Hambledon. Hambledon is down in Hampshire. I think the guy who owns Hambledon, he worked with Paul Roger. But if you tasted that wine, I think you'd be really impressed. It has, you know, the thing that a lot of English sparkling wine didn't have for a number of years was reliable ripeness, because obviously we're a bit more northern. But now I think that they've worked on things. You know, the temperatures have changed slightly, and this year we were impressed again. A champagne won. Le Mondier Bernier actually won this year. But English sparkling wine came second. What was it? I know it came third. It was Harrow and Hope, which is in Marlow, which is a fantastic little domain set up by a husband and wife. I think they're in their 30s and they're just starting off, but they've done amazing work. So I think you'd be surprised, but I don't think you get it in America, do you? I don't think you actually get much English sparkling wine there, or have you see it?
That's why I wanted to ask you, because I saw another interview with you and it came up and I was like, I've actually never thought of anything from there. Like, oh yes, I mean, obviously lagers and cider, but never like, oh, I'm going to get my sparkling wine from anywhere in the UK. Is that in the future? You have the magazine, you did the restaurant, the importer, another restaurant. Are you and Mark just like, going to get a plot of land somewhere and eventually it's just going to be Rotter's own vintages?
Well, you know, I think if we had, you know, £10 million in the bank, getting some land in Essex or Kent or Hampshire, it's not a bad bet. But I think you're doing it for your children or your children's children, you know. But I guess somebody's got to be, you know, the next Louis Roederer of 200 years time. So I think it's an exciting thing to do, but it's really it's something you do when you're properly rich. I think there's so many costs. Land is getting more and more expensive. you know, you've had a lot of investment in English vineyards, but it is exciting. It feels a little bit like the Wild West. If you found the right place, the right soil, you had the right philosophy. You know, I think English sparkling wine is still right at the start of its journey, because the most exciting thing when I go to Champagne is going to see the growers, the small producers. And I'd say that probably at the restaurant, Mark and I, this probably makes this sound idiotic, but we drink champagne the most because it's a day-to-day drink. It's just, it's a light. It's not highly alcoholic, and it always makes you feel good. And the growers have, you know, they've really pushed the boundaries and pushed the quality levels, you know, lower dosage, drier wines, instead of like, you know, more sugary and, you know, that kind of saccharine style, which we're not really into. So I think when the English growers scene comes through, the people with that kind of philosophy, it's going to be really, really interesting. It's just you need a lot of patience and a lot of money. So I don't know if the restaurateurs, we got enough money.
Last question. As an A&R guy, I know that you have so many bands that you had just told people about, shoved in faces, that maybe people didn't listen to you. Who, domain, region, anything that people are just not listening to you right now? This is the next wine. This is the next domain. This is the next area that, you know, get the $20 bottle now, because 2 years from now, it's going to be $500. You'll be off to the next thing.
Oh, gosh. Good question. Hard to spot those kind of price increases. For that kind of increases, you got to be looking at Burgundy and the Jura, I guess.
Fine, but in 200, who's not, who do people need to be paying attention to that they're just not, if they just listen to Dan, they'd be having a glass full of something great.
Yeah, I think, you know, Chianti, for me, going to Chianti, we managed to go in between the lockdowns. And before, I kind of associated Chianti with quite a lot of commercial wines, you know, quite made. And it was a real eye-opener. And you can still get Chianti for very, very reasonable prices, you know, when you compare it to other classic wine regions. And all the people that are in the new issue who I mentioned earlier, they're all organic. They're trying to make wines that are delicate, that have finesse to them rather than power and alcohol. So I would be looking at people like Monte Raponi. You can know their wines are so Burgundian in terms of how they have that sensuality and finesse. And they're not really expensive, but that might be they're not really expensive yet, you know, because as we know, global demand and very small production values, then, you know, the wines disappear. So, I've really fallen in love with Sangiovese over the last few years. This kind of, and I see a similar thing in the best pure Sangiovese as I see in Red Burgundy, for example. So that would be my kind of tip. Amazing. For like complete value.
So before we go, I've asked for a special request. I would like for you to put together five wines and five songs as a pairing. Ideally, it's starting from, you know, however you want to go with the big crescendo. And I'm curious how you would take people through comparing these two, the songs to the wines, and where you see the overlap between the two.
Okay, great. Well, I think I probably should start where I started back in 2013 when I wrote about matching records and wine in the first issue of Noble Rot. And haven't written about it since because I don't know why. You can only do so many. But the first record that we did then was Frankie Knuckles, Your Love. And I read Burgundy by Freddie Mounier and Massini, which is a Grand Cru and one of the most ethereal and sensual of all of his wines. And I guess what I was getting at with that was the sensuality of when you listen to Your Love and it kind of wraps itself around you and it is ethereal and it kind of overlapped with the joy of Red Burgundy, I guess. So that was my match number one. Match number two, Barbra Streisand and Barry Gibb, Guilty. And I mean, I gotta say, I love Barry Gibb's songwriting. I just think he's one of the best. And, you know, a little bit chintzy maybe as a record, a bit of a guilty pleasure. And I think the wine that I'd match it with is a guilty pleasure as well, which is George Vernet Coteau de Vernon Condrieu, which, you know, a bit blousy, quite rich, a little bit out of fashion, low acidity. But I love to drink a Condrieu maybe a couple of times a year when you're in the mood for that. Nothing really can kind of match. And I guess it's the same with Barbra Streisand as well. My third one would be Hamilton Bohannon, Disco Stomp. And I love Hamilton Bohannon. It's just full of joy. And the wine that a record like that makes me think of is a Beaujolais. And one of my favorites is David and Michelle Chappelle and one of their Fleuries. So, yeah, that's just a complete, both of them are just a complete joy. My fourth match will be Napalm Death, Instinct of Survival. And I'm going to match that with Trump Winery Chardonnay. I mean, I think it's taste bud Armageddon and, you know, musical Armageddon in a match made in hell or wherever. And my last match, and this is because how timeless they both are. And I think if I had a shout for my favorite ever record of all time, and my wife always asks me, what do you want played at my your funeral? And I never know. But I think it's probably Screamadelica by Primal Scream. And I can put that record on day after day after day after day, and I just won't get bored of it. I just think it is timeless. And one of the wines I've had that's been the most timeless has been Chateau Latour 1961. And at the age it's at, it still tastes like it was made, you know, 5 years ago. And I think it could go another 100 years. So those two are my kind of timeless finish.
Perfect. Well, Dan, thank you so much. Where can people find your restaurants, find the book, find the magazine? Where can they go?
All good bookshops. And, you know, if you go to www.noblerock.co.uk, then we sell the book, we sell the magazine. We've got prints of the cover. You know, it's got all information about our restaurants as well.
Great.
Let's do it.
We are going to take another musical break, play a song from the archives, and then we'll be back with Adam Schatz of Landlady here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
Thank you. My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Hello, and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. I am joined by Adam Schatz of Landlady. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yes, congratulations on the upcoming fourth release.
Mm-hmm.
It's been interesting to read your writing. By the way, you are a beautiful writer. I have loved
thank
reading
you.
Your essays.
That really means
incredibly, incredibly thoughtful. One of the things that struck me is creating in an almost solitary environment. You talk about that you can't write new songs until old songs are released, and entering into this cycle of record an album, tour, play it out, record an album. And the last year has effectively changed the interaction that you have, or the kind of the cycle of the way in which you create art. So I'm curious about how you have adjusted your expectation in relationship to your creative process, and then what you do with it when you're done completing the process.
That's a great question. And it's one that changes every time, because it's like I've taken enough time between official Landlady releases where it's like if you put out a record every 3 years, it sort of means every time you're readjusting to a new climate that almost never is better. There's almost no situation where people are like, hey, guess what? These things are good now. The only exception being Bandcamp, actually, which I kind of submit to the jury as being the only good company. I think they're the only good company.
We have done this show for many, many years, and I have never heard one bad word about Bandcamp. They're simply the best.
Yeah, it's weird. They don't have to be the best, and they are, but they're the only good one. Any other company, it's like, I don't even think you can be a company and be good because of like the nature of what a company entails, which is thinking about money, which is bad. But your question was about making things and putting them out in this time more than ever. What's interesting, also, every time I make an album, I'm like, this time I'm not going to sit on it. This time it's going to like come out right away and I'm going to be happy. And it never happens. And so this one too, it was like we tracked it. Initially, the band was together live for 6 days in the beginning of 2019. And then I sort of spent that whole year off and on finishing it up at my personal studio. And then, yeah, I was kind of like, all right, 2020 sometime, couldn't find a label. So I was going to put it out myself one way or another. And then it's that feeling hit coming in so many different forms of just like, I don't know when I would ever want to talk about myself again. Just given the way everything was, it's just, and truly for more than one reason. And I just like needed to let time go by. And so, all to say, none of that record that's about to come out was made during the pandemic. It was essentially finished right before any of this started. What I was able to do was use the extended time to think about visuals and work with some artists on that, and really have the luxury of doing that without any sort of like outside pressure that says, okay, we need this now. It needs to be ready, because that's almost always what happens, and you almost always end up with something you're not totally psyched about. And so, yeah, it was just, I was happy to be like, okay, I'm going to take the stimulus check. I'm going to immediately give it to someone else, and then he can make a video, and then we'll see how that can inspire the next stage of the visual world building. But I don't know.
Do you feel that this record, due to the time that you had and the lack of pressure, is a more complete version of a Landlady record? It's your fourth one. Because it didn't have the external cycle?
No, I think it's all the same in that they're all different, because each one is such a good document of who I am at the time and who I'm with at the time. The band has always changed a little bit, but it's always been a pretty good capture of human performance. And I think each one is just growth. It's emblematic of growth, of just being older as a person, as a human being, and then just how the relationships involved in the process overtly in a band, and then behind the scenes, which lead to the songs becoming what they are. It just becomes that. So I don't think it's any more complete. This is, yeah, it's just, again, it's different every time. I mean, this time we put it out ourselves and did it with the Bandcamp vinyl campaign, which was sort of a pseudo crowdfunding thing where you don't produce the physical stuff until it's, the overhead is covered, which is actually such a dream, because again, you're not like sinking your own capital into it and then ending up with 1,000 LPs in your basement just kind of waiting for a flood to get you that sweet insurance money.
Can we hear a song?
Oh, sure. Let's
what are you gonna play for us first?
The first song I'm going to play, and this was a little tricky actually to pick songs, because when I write songs for Landlady, they inevitably become something that I think only can be played by the band. And there's always, every record, there's usually one or two that I'll let spill over into my solo show. But for the most part, I just deem them unplayable for whatever reason. And so when I sat down to figure out which ones I would do for this time period, when I really can't play with each other, I was like, all right, there's three, I think only three, at least ones that I could play without totally screwing up. So this first one is called AM Radio, and I'm going to try it alone.
Great. Here we have Landlady on Snacky Tunes.
At least we were told the West was wild. AM Radio on the dial. I bet if we closed our eyes so tight that the patterns look like light. You are counted on, count on me. Lost between the low frequencies. I bet if we closed our eyes so tight that the patterns look like light. How fast do you run when you're scared? AM radio will be there. I bet if we closed our eyes so tight that the patterns look like light. The fall, the spring, the winter night.
Favorite types of musicians, because you also have such a strong affinity for food. Mm-hmm. I read that you've been to sourdough for 7 years, which is a very strong claim, as most people have had less than a year under their belt.
Losers. Posers, but we welcome them. We welcome all of them in. It was,
are people going to be still making bread when they like it's post-vaccine, or how many people are going to stay true to their love of it?
I think the people who fell off already fell off because it's a thing. Okay. No one wanted it to go on for this long. And so it's with any of it, I feel like everyone's relationship with these things, we're all on the same trajectory where it's like, okay, I'm going to watch like movies all day. I'm just going to like, dude, cause this is, we're going to like pretend this is a cool thing where we get to just like be with our loved ones all the time or watch movies all the time, whatever the reason. And then as it slowly became real that we can't do that, then you just start any sort of like fun pandemic habit. I think at this point is gone for everyone other than, of course, you know, deep depression that'll stay with us forever. But it was fun. I did actually truly enjoy all of the messages I would get over the first like 3 months or so of quarantine, just sort of seeing me as being some sort of sourdough whisperer from friends who knew that I did it because I posted it on, you know, Instagram a bunch in the past. And they're just like, hey, what do I do? Is this working? Is this not working? And I was actually totally happy about it. And it's really fun to give people bread advice because it's actually kind of a complex and weird thing.
You also were compiling a spreadsheet of places to stop while on tour under the name Tour Food, which oh, yeah. I have always wanted this. We've had this discussion come up over the years on Snacky Tunes about having routes that are maybe like an extra hour out of your way, but it's going to be the best barbecue or great falafel. What is the history of it and where is it now?
Totally. Well, and let me just say too, it's, you know, Tour Food, now that it's launched, is it's me and my two close buddies, Charlie Ferguson and Luke Payenson. Luke and I grew up in Newton, Massachusetts together. Our band's playing together. And his mom is a food journalist and actually wrote for the Boston Globe. And then he was writing about food at a really young age. And then Charlie and I toured in a bunch of bands together, an Afrobeat band, Zongo Junction. And that's kind of where I did my first like real US touring. And then also like my first sort of bout of irresponsible eating while touring, which can only happen when you're like 22.
When I get, how do you define irresponsible eating?
It's like barbecue every day, basically. Okay. Like when you're going to, you know, if you're hitting the South and you're like, okay, we're in these places, like we're in Charleston, we're in Louisville, we're in Birmingham, all these places. It's like, we got to do it. And I do get these like Facebook memories every so often of some like disgusting looking plate of food. I was like, first of all, why did I put that on the internet? And second of all, the fact that I could get away with it then, because now when I tour, I just can't. I mean, especially when it's like nights when I'm singing and stuff, but it's, I was happy to get away with it then. But basically around that time, we started a spreadsheet. I just started an Excel spreadsheet because I wanted to keep track of places that we ate that were good. And we shared it with other touring musicians, and ton of great people were on the spreadsheet. And we just like, I would check in with it over the years, and then more and more people would get added to it because I would invite people and then other people would invite people. And it became this like really wonderful crowdsourced list of places to eat around the country that were sort of authorized by touring musicians. And it's like, you know, not everyone has a trusted palate for that sort of thing, but we do. We eat everywhere. It's often the only thing in the day other than the show, and the show is like 1 hour long, so at most. So we're spending more time each day eating than playing music, which is sad. And it's like, yeah, we, those of us who really value that time, just it felt like a cool way to share this information. And so last year, 2 years ago, 2019, I wanted to really turn this into an actual searchable database and a website that anyone could use. And so I got Charlie and Luke to go in on it with me, and we just vetted all the places that were on there, reached out to regional experts to sort of pad it out, you know, if there's a city where we didn't have a lot of things, or, you know, hit up my Richmond people and be like, what's missing that wasn't there before. And then, yeah, worked with a web designer to just make it a really easy to update thing. And we didn't have too much criteria other than that we wanted you to be able to search by location, search by type of food, and then also plug in your route. So you could do point A to point B and then see on a map all the places that were along the way. And then we just put it up and we're excited to see what happened. And that was October of 2019. So I think it had a good like 3 months before nobody was on tour again.
Did anyone use it during the pandemic when people like weren't flying or were driving cross country?
Yes. And I was, which was awesome. Because when it all became clear what was happening, we were just so depressed because it's like, man, we spent so much time checking all of these restaurants to make sure they were like open and real. And the fear that they are all going to be closed by the time this is over was really a very sad thing. And I sad for them and then sad for me, who potentially wasted like months out of a year just looking at a spreadsheet. But I'm actually hopeful that the places we were spotlighting on these, because we also set more or less a price limit of like $20 or under, because we wanted this to be for everyone. And it's, you know, there are definitely people who like to go on tour and engage with fine dining, but it's like not, that wasn't what we were trying to serve. And there's also, you know, those resources are available. You can find the best food in any city if you have no limits. But if you're at a venue and you're only walking or whatever, we wanted to make something that was for those types of people. But I'm hopeful that actually a lot of the smaller places are going to make it through this in one way or another, either because they were better equipped for takeout or who knows why. But I'm hoping we don't have to start from scratch. But yeah, a lot of people crossing the country every so often would either write to me saying that they found a great place and were grateful, or if it was, you know, kind of one of our representatives, they'd say, hey, we found a new place. You should add this to the database.
Amazing. Can we hear another song?
Okay, let's do it. What am I going to play? I'm going to play, this is another song off the new Landlady album called Landlady, and the song is called Nowhere to Hide.
Ear to the shell, but the sound won't come out. Whose opinion do I have to doubt? All my food's gone bad again. Give me a home where the lake hits the clouds. Show me where the bottles get their name. Turn to pieces, turn to grain. I've been too lost for many a tide. No one to run from and nowhere to hide. From the small intestine to the brains, all my parts are good again. Give me a home where the waves hit the clouds. Let our birthday wishes be out loud. What's the hurt in making sense? I've walked on logs with thorns in my side. No one to run from and nowhere to hide. To run from and nowhere to hide.
side, no one to run from, nowhere to hide. I've been too lost for many a tide, no one to run from and nowhere to hide. I walked on logs with thorns in my side, no one to run from and nowhere to hide. I've been too lost for many a tide, no one to run from and nowhere to hide. I walked on logs with thorns in my side, no one to run from and nowhere to hide. I'm too lost to many a tide, no one to run from and nowhere to hide. I walked on logs with thorns in my side, no one to run from and nowhere to hide. I've been too lost for many a tide, no one to run from and nowhere to hide. I walked on, I walked on logs with thorns in my side, no one to run from and nowhere to hide.
As I mentioned, you're a great writer, and you recently published an op-ed in the New York Times, which I highly encourage anyone listening to pause and read the op-ed, as we don't need to dissect it here. And you also did a very lengthy Instagram Live about it. One of the things that popped out to me was the phrase, you've had a relentless year of learning. As you said, sourdoughs were, you know, maybe a trend that came and went, but it seems that the thing that didn't leave you was learning, and specifically around learning this Randy Newman song. And from practicing this song every day for an hour or 2 hours, I'm curious, like, what that repetition did for you as a musician, and a lover of music, and a songwriter and a performer, and what you got from it in a way that maybe playing live shows or writing new songs maybe gave you different things or the same thing.
That's an awesome question. The beauty of learning other people's songs, and especially by, like, really being strict with yourself about what learning, how much you really want to learn the song. Because when I was a kid learning covers, I would sort of go only as far as would make it easy for me to say I was playing the song. You know, if I want to play Where's My Mind, I'm going to go to the Guitar Tabs website and look up what someone says the chords are, and then I'm going to say that's what it is, and I'm going to play it, and that'll be great. And then kind of going through music school and just being around people I admire and respect all the time and seeing how they learn and internalize things, it kind of pushed me to a place where I've gotten a lot of joy out of getting really deep into the intricacies of learning a song. And you just, it's fun to push yourself almost to impossible lengths and be like, okay, how close can I really get to playing this exactly the way that Randy Newman played this? Or if I'm learning a, you know, Donny Hathaway song, can I learn his exact vocal phrasing on the live version of I Love You More Than You Will Ever Know? Because that's incredible. The way he sings that song is, like, so nuts, the way he throws the melody around. And by kind of zooming in on really specific components of a song, you just, it becomes a part of you. And it does it in an exciting way where I can't answer your question. I can't say what it does for me, only that it does something. And it's a beautiful thing, because then pieces of these songs will come out in my songwriting and will come out in my performance and will come out in my listening and my ability to hear and understand what other people are doing after that. I mean, after spending like 5 months with the Randy Newman song, I moved on to this James Booker piece. James Booker is an unbelievable New Orleans piano player, and it's his version of the song On the Sunny Side of the Street. And it's a stride, like New Orleans style stride piano, which is impossible. And I've never played stride before. And so it took me so long to even get, like, remotely presentable. But the stuff I picked up from Randy Newman made that easier for me, because your ear starts to recognize harmony and motion on the instrument a little bit better. And it's all, yeah, it's instinct driven. You're just kind of like sharpening your internal instinct and aptitude. And that I really never get tired of that.
Well, I want to make sure we have time for one more song, but where can people find you? Where can they get the new record? Where can they get the old records? Where can they find your writings? Where can they get the travel food website? How do they get all of your universe?
Oh, great. Wouldn't it be great if I put it all in one place? But it, so the, you can find all the new, I'm building a new place where all my fun stuff lives. So if you go to landladyland.com, there's some fun videos for the new songs, and there's a news feed where I'm going to start publishing a bunch of writing. I'm putting out a big essay there right when the record comes out. So that's a good place to go for that. The food website is tourfood.us for finding places to eat. And there's a submission section on that also, which has been, we were kind of the most excited about that, where we were just saying, okay, we're going to do as much research as we can, but once we go live, people are going to send us what they think the best food is in between Pittsburgh to Cincinnati. And so we love hearing about that stuff and doing the research. And yeah, a lot of my writing lives on the Talkhouse. If you go to thetalkhouse.com, you can find a bunch of my essays under my own name.
Awesome. What is the last song you're going to play for us?
The last song is called Tooth and Nail. And yeah, you can get the new record on Bandcamp, landlady.bandcamp.com. That's all the stuff. Give us all your money and we'll send you all the good things.
Amazing. I want to thank our food guest, Dan Keeling from Noble Rot, whose new book is out now. You can get it everywhere. Adam, thank you so much for joining us. And we will be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes here on HRN.
Hearts has been broke. All of my numbers are lower than seven. It could be a gift. If this were any other game, do take your time when you leave. Waiting upstairs. Waiting for words to make us whole. I'll take the elevator down, wheeling you in, tooth and nail, tooth and nail.
This program is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.